You Skype things with this. How is the great Emperor Parikshit, who is a highly intelligent and great devotee, born in that womb? How does his death take place? And what did he achieve after his death? Purport. The king of Hastinapur, now Delhi, used to be the emperor of the world, at least until the time of the son of Emperor Parikshit. Maharaja Parikshit was saved by the Lord in the womb of his mother, so he could certainly be saved from an untimely death due to the ill will of a son of a brahmana. Because the age of Kali began to act just after the assumption of power by Maharaj Parikshit, the first sign of misgivings was exhibited in the cursing of such a greatly intelligent and devoted king as Maharaj Parikshit. The king is the protector of the helpless citizens, and their welfare, peace, and prosperity depend on him. Unfortunately, by the instigation of the fallen age of Kali, an unfortunate Brahmana's son was employed to condemn the innocent Maharaj Parikshit, and so the king had to prepare himself for death within 7 days. History will ever record this unfortunate incident of how a great king was killed by the unkind intrigue of the fallen son of a Brahmana. Maharaj Parikshit is especially famous as one who was protected by Vishnu, and when he was unduly cursed by a Brahmana's son, he could have invoked the mercy of the Lord to save him, but he did not want to because he was a pure devotee. A pure devotee never asks the Lord for any undue favor. Maharaj Parikshit knew that the curse of the Brahmana's son upon him was unjustified, as everyone else knew, but he did not want to counteract it because he knew also that the age of Kali had begun and that the first symptom of the age, namely degradation of the highly talented Brahmana community, had also begun. He did not want to interfere with the current of the time, but he prepared himself to meet death very cheerfully and very properly. Being fortunate, he got at least 7 days to prepare himself to meet death, and so he properly utilized the time in the association of Shukadev Goswami, the great saint and devotee of the Lord. Tasya janma mahabhure karmani cha mahatmanaha Nidanam cha yatai vasit sa precha gatavanyata. How was the great Emperor Parikshit, who was a highly intelligent and great devotee, born in that womb? How did his death take place? And what did he achieve after his death? The great emperor of the world, not just the king of Delhi, but as Prabhupada says here, the emperor of the world. Of course, emperor of the world was quite different in those days. Everything was managed locally. Things were not managed directly by the emperor. So there was local governance. There were small kings. You could be the king of a village or the king of a small city, what we have now, what we now call in America, at least the mayor. And then there were also kings of greater countries. Something like what we have in America, we have cities within states, and states within a country. And in America, the states can make their own laws as long as those laws do not contradict the federal laws, the laws of the greater country. So they had a similar system, except that in the modern day, one pays taxes local, state, and federal. In those days, you only paid local taxes, and then the local administrator paid a portion of those taxes to the greater king, who paid a portion of those taxes to the greater king. And it was a lot more respect, in other words, for self-governance and individual governments. And the emperor only directly would interfere in local business if there was some aberration of duty, if people were not actually working towards sacrifice. As Prabhupada says here, the helpless citizens, their welfare, peace, and prosperity depended on the king. So this is what's necessary for a sane society. At the modern time, the people who are in the position of the kshatriyas, of the government leaders, even if they have some genuine desire to help the prosperity of the citizens, they don't know how to go about it. First of all, the modern political systems are designed to cut down the power of the leader. That's their purpose. Right? I mean, all of us in this world, we feel insufficiently protected by our government, isn't it? Who can say, I feel that my government is giving me proper protection? I feel secure under my government. I'm sure that all of us have some money, but that money is probably in the form of paper that is certified by our government. If our government were to fall or come into difficulty, then all of a sudden we wouldn't have any wealth anymore. And with the present economic situation, we don't have any kind of security, even in regards to our property and our wealth. Everything is in a topsy-turvy condition. It used to be that the government would give people full security in eating, sleeping, mating, and defending, and in achieving liberation. They would engage the citizens in yagya, yagya artat kamano natra loko yam karma vandana taratam karma kotaya mukta sangha samatra. They would engage people in worshiping the Lord so that people would achieve dharma, artha, kama, and moksha, that people could achieve liberation from this material world, not simply dharma, artha, and kama. And a king like Maharaj Parikshit, he was not interested just in moksha. He was interested in prema pumartha mahan, the fifth goal of life, as enunciated by Mahaprabhu. And that is loving service to the Lord. Indeed, he had seen the Lord in the womb of his mother, Uttara. So what an incredible situation. Of course, we are interested, as far as possible in this age of Kali, in reviving such a system of government. Although it's very difficult. Unfortunately, just like there are so many bad experiences with Brahmanas, here it says that the fall down of the Brahmanas is what starts the age of Kali. Now, first, the Brahmanas become corrupt. As the Brahmanas become corrupt, the power moves into the hands of the Kshatriyas. As the Kshatriyas become corrupt, it moves into the hands of the Vaishyas. As the Vaishyas become corrupt, it moves into the hands of the Shudras. If we look just at history, not in the last 5,000 years, which we don't know a whole lot about, but if we look at history that we know a lot about, say in the last 1,500 to 2,000 years in Europe, we can see this progression. We can see that originally the religious leaders were ruling the royalty. Although there was royalty, the royalty was under the control of the religious leaders. But the religious leaders became corrupt in so many ways. People could pay money in order to be free from their sins and be guaranteed to go to heaven. And because of this corruption, the kings eventually overthrew the religious leaders. We saw this happen, for example, in Britain, where King Henry overthrew the Roman Catholic Church and established his own church, the Anglican Church, which was under his control. And then the Kshatriyas, now not being under the control of Brahmanas, they also became corrupt. And therefore, they were also overthrown in the American Revolution and the French Revolution. And of course, they were replaced by the Vaishyas. And there is attempt to overthrow the Vaishyas, such in the Communist Revolution. In most countries of the world today, things are being run by wealthy business persons. Wealthy business persons, corrupt Vaishyas, are controlling the government, they're controlling the military, and they're controlling the intellectuals. They're the ones who are funding the universities, and either directly or indirectly through the government, practically all scientific and religious institutions. It's very, very rare to find somebody who's operating, especially in any kind of big way, out of the control of corrupt Vaishyas. So we're in a very sad situation. And if we had real kings who were under the control of real Brahmanas, we would all feel safe and secure. We'd feel safe regarding crime. We'd feel safe regarding our economic prosperity. We'd even feel safe regarding our sense gratification. We'd be in a society where family situations were stable, where there wasn't divorce and remarriage five times and people running away from their responsibility. Krishna talks about this in the third chapter of Bhagavad Gita. He tells Arjuna, you have to do your duty, because if you don't do your duty, there'll be unwanted population. He says, even I have to do my duty for that purpose, because as soon as the leaders run away from their duty, then the ordinary citizens think, well, why do I have to take care? You know, this woman was nice when I married her, and now she's gotten old and fat, and my children are whining and throwing tantrums. Let me go find somebody else. So, you know, or the woman thinks, oh, you know, this guy seemed like a knight in shining armor, and now he's kind of fat and leaves the socks on the floor, and let me find somebody else. So this situation didn't exist. People had stability even in the material aspects of their life, even in the weather. You know, in this past week, there were two freak earthquakes, one in Colorado and one in Maryland. And the government, they can't do anything about these sort of things. You know, all they can do is send out paltry relief efforts like they did after Hurricane Katrina. And then people criticize, oh, the government doesn't take care of us. But in Mara Frickett, he could control even the weather. Why? Because he was offering yajna. The demigods were satisfied. It wasn't too hot. It wasn't too cold. People were living just like here in Hawaii, where it never gets too hot or too cold. But even here, at least where I am, we have too much rain. So under a king like Parikit, there was never too much rain or not enough rain, as explained by the Brahmana whose children were kidnapped, that it would rain at night. It would just rain at night. So there was plenty of rain, but nobody was ever disturbed by the rain. And even the Brahman explains that children never died before their parents. So the kings were so responsible that people lived a happy, healthy life. One conversation, Prabhupada says, why do the archaeologists not dig up hospitals? They dig up grand temples, but not hospitals, even though medical science was so much more advanced. There was no need. Under the auspices of such a great emperor as Parikit, people's health was good. People lived their full lifespan. The earth was producing without any need of artificial chemicals or fertilizers. What a wonderful, come imagine, what a wonderful society to live in, where all your material needs are amply provided for, amply, excessively. The members of the family in Vrindavan, Krishna's family, they had so many milk products that they could use them to throw at each other in celebrations. They could cover each other with yogurt and milk and ghee as a form of festivity. Now, who can imagine? And they could give away mountains of grains and thousands of cows who were producing so much milk they were muddying the pasture ground with their milk, and nobody was feeding them hormones. Nobody was artificially breeding them. So this is the kind of society we want to create. Of course, we're very hesitant. We're very hesitant to give much power to Brahmins, especially to Kshatriyas. Even in our devotee community, we've seen that the one class of people who are not really activated are the Kshatriyas. We become afraid. We think, oh, that person is just interested in social welfare work, and we denigrate them. But we're very hesitant to give power to those who want to take care of people on a mass scale. Of course, these people still exist, and if they don't have the facility to collect taxes, we'll see they'll collect charity and then redistribute it for the public good. I know of several such people like this, but nobody feels comfortable to give them a lot of authority and responsibility in the society of devotees. And this lack of comfort very much comes from our general upbringing. You know, those of us in democracies, democracy doesn't just mean that you vote. Voting is actually a very small part of a democracy. And those of you familiar with American history, you may know that the original system of voting was that only intelligent and upper class people could vote. Voting wasn't given, it wasn't mass voting. So although it was voting, it was just, the idea was land, male landowners. Of course, their criteria for intelligence was skewed. You know, you had to be a white male landowner. But the concept was very good, that voting should be done by people who had the intelligence how to vote. You didn't have to have the candidates. You know, we've got this huge public debt, and the candidates are spending millions of dollars on advertising themselves. I thought if you could have a candidate stand up and say, listen, we've got a whatever it is, so many trillion dollar debt, why don't you take all of your campaign pledges and just put it into paying off the debt, and I'm not going to campaign. That's going to be my campaign. My campaign is take all the money you would have used to have me run for president and give it to the country directly, right? So there wasn't any system like that because voting was done by intelligent people who really knew the candidate. That was the original idea in the democracy. And even in Vedic times, the votes of the Brahmanas were very important as to who should be the king. The king didn't just necessarily install his eldest son, no matter what the qualifications. Of course, sometimes that happened, but that was not the system. But anyway, to go back, democracy is not simply a system of voting, even a good system of voting. Modern democracy is set up to take down the power of the ruling person. That's why there's these three systems of government. So the president cannot write laws. He can only sign into law what's written by the legislature, or he can veto the laws of the legislature. Then they can override him if it goes back to the legislature by a two-third vote. And then the judicial can interpret the law such that the original intention is changed. So the leading governor has very little power, doesn't stay in power for a very long time, is subjected to the votes of the populace, and even while in power, has so many checks and balances that he can't do very much. So this feeling that we have that whoever's the leader should have just barely enough power to rule comes from our experiences with corrupt kshatriyas. And we feel the same about the brahmanas. We feel the same about religious leaders. You know, don't give them too much power. Even in ISKCON, this mood is very prevalent. Make sure that people in a position of religious authority have a lot of checks and balances on their power. And again, this mood comes from direct experiences with abuse of power. And all of this began with the story that we're reading about today. Maharaj Parikshit, the beginning of the fall of the Brahmanas. So why didn't Parikshit do anything about it? That's also a question here. Why didn't he do anything? Why didn't he counteract it? Why didn't he say, okay, this Sringi, this Brahmin boy, he's just one bad apple. You know, take care of him before it contaminates the rest of the Brahmanas. Let me counteract this curse and subjugate this foolish Brahmana. And he could have done that. He had the ability to do that. First of all, he was a pet devotee of the Lord. The Lord had already saved him once in the womb of his mother. The Lord could easily save him again, and the Lord could easily counteract the situation. And would he do so at the request of his devotee? Why not? The Lord is very open to the submissive requests of his beloved devotee. But Maharaj Parikshit didn't want to do that. And why is that? Because he could understand that what was happening was ultimately Krishna's will. That it was ultimately Krishna's will. And we see this cycle everywhere in nature. Spring, summer, fall, winter. Waking up, middle of the day, evening, nighttime. Birth, growing, youth, vitality, middle age, old age, death, rebirth. Dehino smenyata dehe komaram yovanam jaha. Tata dehantara pratya dhirasattva namuyate. Everything is going through this cycle. This cycle is, there is a reason for this cycle in nature, and this cycle happens also on a cosmic scale. That there is the age of truth. And then gradually things degrade to the age of falsity. And then again there is renewal. So just like Hiranyakashipu, he wanted to have the trees always bear fruit. He forced all of the vegetation and the trees to bear fruit all year. He wasn't content with the natural cycle of wake and sleep, growth and dormancy that's ordained by the Lord. Whereas the devotee, they are happy to let things go in the natural cycle, not to stop them, but to cooperate with them. Of course, we had Priyavrata, who wasn't content with the movement of the sun and created his own sun. But generally, the devotees are seeing that the Lord's plan is perfect, that there's a reason for the Kali Yuga. After all, every living entity needs to get a chance to be a human being. Durlava manava janma. Durlava janma. It's very rare, manava janma, to take birth as a human being. And every living entity needs a chance to take birth as a human being. But how could every living entity take birth as a human being in such a yuga? They're not qualified. There has to be a time and a place when the less qualified living entities can also get a human birth. There has to be some facility. And so there's different yugas. Krishna's making facility for everyone. And Kali Yuga cannot exist if there's kings like Maharaj Parikshit. Then it wouldn't be Kali Yuga. It would be something else. I remember many years ago, Ridha Nandamar was giving a lecture. He said if you just took all of the materialistic people and put them in Vaikuntha, they'd look around and say, oh, a bunch of Hare Krishnas, and they'd leave. The living entities who can only be human in a degraded environment, they couldn't function under Maharaj Parikshit. They couldn't function under qualified brahmanas. Now we see this on a micro scale, that if we have some center for Krishna consciousness, that some people can't function in it. I need to have my tea. I need to have my coffee. Sometimes devotees may see this when their non-devotee relatives come to visit. We've had non-devotee relatives say, sorry, I can't stay with you. I have to have my coffee in the morning. They can't function in that atmosphere. Just like a very high-class person, they can't function in a degraded atmosphere. If you take some devotee of the Lord and ask them to function in a nightclub, they can't. Practically, they can't breathe. You know, get me out of here. So there has to be facility for everything. Therefore, Maharaj Parikshit willingly cooperated. It says here he did not want to interfere with the current of the time. He thought, let me be cooperative. So he prepared to meet death, Prabhupada says, very cheerfully and very properly. So this is the difference between the demon and the devotee. Kamsa was told, you're going to be killed. And he fought it with everything he had. He used all of his power, all of his intelligence, all of his time, everything to fight against the inevitable. I mean, Vasudev said to him on the chariot, hey, my dear brother-in-law, everybody's got to die. What is the problem? And here we see Parikshit, he can understand this is Krishna's will. And another verse, I'm not sure exactly which verse, it says that Maharaj Parikshit saw that Krishna had taken the form of the curse. He actually saw the Lord in that form. The Lord has now taken the form of this curse. He saw Krishna. He understood this was the will of Krishna. So we have many questions here about how we can apply this today. Our first question would be, well, if this is meant to be the age of Kali, then why are we preaching? Let the age of Kali go on in its own way, and why interfere with that? In fact, Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that don't disturb the minds of the ignorant. Just show them a better example, but let them be. And of course, there in the purport, Prabhupada says that the devotees knowing the plan of the Lord are more merciful than the Lord. In other words, the Lord doesn't want to disturb his devotees by asking them to preach to the atheists. Although he says there's no one more dear to him than such a preacher. He doesn't want to insist on it. Also, preaching has to be done in a way that doesn't agitate others. So anyway, our answer to this question is that at the time of Maharaj Parikshit, the only plan of the Lord was bringing in the age of Kali. But at the present time, there's a dual plan of the Lord. And that is not only that the age of Kali is here, but that he's come as Mahaprabhu, which he comes once in every 1,000 ages of Kali, to flood the world with Krishna Prema. This can also be seen, just like I remember, especially in North Carolina, we would have a situation in the winter. The winters there were not so severe, where there would be some days that were like spring. Of course, the downside of that is sometimes the trees would get pooled and start to flower. Then the flowers would be killed off by a frost and we wouldn't get any fruit. But that would happen. We had photographs of being outside in winter coat and one day later being outside in a t-shirt. That was very common. So in this particular Kali Yuga, every 1,000 Kali Yugas, there's a brief period of time. Kali Yuga is 432,000 years. And of that time, only 10,000 years. Not a long time. Right? 10,000 years, you figure out the percentage of 432,000. Small amount of time. There's a few days where, again, it will shine. It can shine, like Satya Yuga, Prabhupada says. Again, Satya Yuga can be reinstated. A little glimmer of light, like in a rainstorm. Sometimes it stops raining for a moment, and this sun rays are streaking through a hole in the cloud. And again, the clouds come and cover the sky. So we are at this opportunity where there's a brief break in the clouds of Kali Yuga. And Prabhupada said, do not take your birth again and again in this Kali Yuga, because things will get very degraded. You know, if we're not careful, if after this life we take birth on the heavenly planets and then again come back to the earth planet, this movement of Mahaprabhu will be over. It's a brief snatch of time. And of course, like anything, there is a starting and a winding down. There's a sanja, there's the juncture. So Mahaprabhu appeared a little over 500 years ago, and we can see that the movement is building in momentum. It hasn't fully crested. Certainly, we have not yet established a Satya Yuga situation. And then it will also gradually decline. So gradually build up, peak, and then gradually decline. You see, that's how Krishna arranges everything. So for us at the present time, our cooperating with the current of the time means to cooperate with Mahaprabhu's movement, with bringing in this sunshine to the age of Kali. And Prabhupada said, by Sankirtan, we can again establish both real Brahmanas and real Kshatriyas. Now, I'm not sure if that means that the real Brahmanas will have mystic powers and the real Kshatriyas will be able to fight with 10,000 elephants. That, I doubt if I'll live to find out the answer to that in this body at any rate. But that is how we cooperate with the currents of time. So that's the answer to one question. So if we are going to follow in the footsteps of Maharaj Parikshit and cooperate with the current of time according to the will of the Lord, then we do not stand idly by and watch Kali take over while we retire to a hermitage. But we are actively involved with spreading Krishna consciousness. And of course, if we look around, we see two things happening simultaneously. We see Kali Yuga advancing. Undoubtedly, Kali Yuga is advancing. And we could give a whole list of how it's advancing now versus 20 years or 30 years or 40 years ago. Now, 40 years ago, abortion was illegal. And now, not only is it legal, but a woman carrying twins can abort one of the twins because she just doesn't feel like taking care of two babies. That's so many examples. But we also see that Mahaprabhu's movement is advancing. And when I was growing up, I didn't know a vegetarian. Now, 1/4 of the people in the United Kingdom are vegetarians. Big meat restaurant chains are offering vegetarian options. Our former President Clinton has gone vegan for his health. People are understanding vegetarianism is more healthful. That's amazing. I mean, when I was a kid, People thought a vegetarian diet, what to speak of a vegan diet, would be very unhealthy. They'd say you die following such a diet. And now everyone can understand, oh yes, that's healthier. So many people are interested in yoga, maybe just hatha yoga or whatever, but they're interested in yoga. Kirtan is spreading. Again, maybe Mayavadi's doing the kirtan, which is probably our fault. But anyway, people are very interested in kirtan. So many people, I think it's about a fourth of Americans, believe in reincarnation. So we see that there is a movement. There is a movement in general swelling towards the flooding of the world with prema bhakti. Then we have, that's maybe a general question, but then we have a more personal question. So Maharaj Parikshit didn't interfere with the plan of the Lord because he knew that this was the overall plan. But what about for our own self? I mean, if I get diagnosed with some disease, I'm probably not going to think, well, the disease of Urmila is crucial to the whole plan of the world, because 99.99999%, that's not true. I mean, even Haridas Thakur said, my dear Lord, whether I live or die has no meaning. I'm just like an insect. He said, if an insect dies, who takes notice of it? And when I take a walk every morning, inevitably, I see roadkill, usually frogs, some dead frog on the road or a dead snail. Who cares for it? There's no funeral. What to speak of a dead mosquito? You know, when you're driving and the dead insects come on the windshield of your car, do you have a funeral? Who cares for it? Nobody cares. Some animal dies in the woods. It makes no difference to anybody at all. Or if there's some big catastrophe, you know, a tsunami or an earthquake, and they'll just pile everybody in a mass grave. My living, my dying, my disease, I mean, it has no import to the world. Hardly even has an import to my family. I was just reading that from, who was Bhishma in the Mahabharata. So, you know, we die, our family comes to the funeral, they cry, and then they leave and they go about their own business. You know, when my parents died, I cried, I mourned, I was sad. For maybe a year, I intensely missed them. Now, the first few months, something would happen, I'd think, oh, I have to call my mother, oh, she's not there. Right? I know one of my friends, whose wife died, he told me that for months, he would want to turn around and say, oh yeah, she's not there. But after a while, you go on with your own life. 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. How much meaning does it have? So if something happens to me, I'm not going to think, okay, well, I have to counteract this for the good of the world. We have an expression. Someone thinks they're God's gift to the world. So none of us should think I'm God's gift to the world, and I have to keep on living because without me, the world will fall apart. What will happen? Prabhupada really criticizes this mentality. He talks about Gandhi, who wasn't willing to step down in his old age because he thought, well, without me, India will suffer. So we shouldn't have any such consideration. Right? My daughter-in-law here is recovering from having her wisdom teeth out, and there were complications. And so I've been doing a lot of extra work around the house, and one of my grandsons looked at me and said, wow, Grandma, we're so lucky you're here. What would we do without you? I said, you know, Krishna has an infinite number of servants, and if I wasn't here, I'm sure he would arrange something else. So that's the reality. Therefore, when we look at what's happening to us and whether or not we should counteract it, we really have to ask that question much more in personal terms. To think, you know, I should counteract this or not because I have so much important service to do and the world's going to stop turning without me is simply hubris. So how am I going to decide just for myself? Okay, I've been, you know, I don't think many of us have to worry about curses. Maybe some people do, but at least I don't worry about it. You know, if somebody comes and says, Ermi Lai curse you to die, I'd look at them and say, right, like you don't have any power to curse me. So we don't have to worry about that, but we may have to worry about other sorts of obstacles in our life. Maybe disease, maybe some sort of money problem, some problem with another person. All of us have obstacles. And if you haven't noticed, there's always some sort of obstacle. You know, have you noticed that? That we'll think, okay, my life is great except for A, B, and C. And if I could just get rid of A, B, and C, then everything's going to be fantastic. So we pour our energy into getting rid of A, B, and C. And wouldn't you know it, a D pops up. I was saying this to my son the other day about the house. I said, you know, isn't there always something to fix around the house? The other day, one of the cabinet doors came off its hinges. Right? And the lock for the cabinet where we keep the kids' games just broke. And the childproof device on his office door stopped working. And so, okay, you fix those things. I tell you, something else will break. Something else. As soon as you think, you know, okay, I got it done. Took care of this problem, got rid of this difficult person in my life, solved my money problem, you know, fixed the leaky roof, something else will happen. Definitely. So we all have these things in our life and we worry, we wonder, what's the most Krishna conscious thing to do? To leave it broken and tolerate it? Or to fix it thinking this belongs to Krishna? And it's my service to fix it. Of course, the real reason we may want to fix it is so we'll be materially comfortable. That we also have to examine. And then that's not ultimately a terrible thing. It's not that we should never want to have some materially peaceful situation in order to execute our Krishna consciousness. But I've personally come up with a very simple flowchart for answering this question. When do I try to counteract difficulties in life? So the first question, and if I were physically in front of you, I'd draw this on the board as a flow chart. The first question would be, do I have the ability to counteract this problem? Is there a solution? Does a solution exist that I can even do? Sometimes the answer is no. Sometimes it's an insolvable problem. You know, if there's an earthquake, what do? You can't stop it. I can't make some plan. Okay, I'm going to stop the earthquake. When Prahlad was being tortured by his father, he didn't have an option to stop it. His father was running the whole universe. Even Prahlad's guru, Narada, was superficially offering obeisances to Hiranyakashipu. I mean, who was Prahlad going to go to? There was no CPO. So that's the first question. Is this something that I can counteract? And there may have to be some exploration for that. You know, you may have to go to a doctor and say, is this a curable disease? But that may not be a question you can answer immediately. And if the answer is no, there's no counteraction, then you accept. This is the will of the Lord. And as Prabhupada says, you're cheerfully. You accept it very cheerfully. Tatain yukamapam sushamikshamanam. This reaction is due to my own past activities. Now, recently, I had some people criticizing me for something imaginary. And I was thinking, okay, how much am I going to defend myself? I thought, you know, you defend yourself, doesn't matter. You can keep defending yourself, and these people go on and on and on, and the more you talk about it, then the more other people talk about it. And it never gets solved that way, so just ignore it, and if you ignore it, it will go away. And I thought, this is happening to me from some sort of something on my part, either some sin I did in another lifetime or some thing in this lifetime where I criticized an innocent person or who knows, but it's some reaction for my purification. So let me accept it cheerfully and go on with my service. Because I don't really have a means to counteract it. Anything I try to do to counteract it will just make it worse. So leave it alone. All right, now let's say you do have a means to counteract it. Suppose you actually can counteract it. Then you say, all right, is this means of counteracting it Is it legal? Is it moral? Is it ethical? And most of all, would it please Krishna? Just like I knew one gentleman who had gotten into terrible debt, and the way that he was going to get out of debt was by working 100 hours a week. So he had no more time for sadhana, he had no more time for his family. So this kind of solution, that's not really a solution. So if our only solution, or I knew one other devotee, he wanted to start a prasadam distribution program. He expanded it to be a shelter for homeless people, but he didn't have enough money to do it. And he decided he was going to get money from the government, but the government said, all right, we'll give you money, but then you have to allow meat eating, you have to allow smoking, you have to allow illicit sex. And he said, okay, sure. So if your only way out of your problem is to do something immoral or unethical or something that will harm your spirituality, then again, you tolerate. Not just tolerate like, but as here, Parikshit, cheerfully. Cheerfully, joyfully embrace, just like all of us we were talking the other day about embracing Krishna. So you see that Krishna has taken the form of this difficulty and you embrace the difficulty as Krishna. All right, now let's say you do have a means of counteracting that would be pleasing to Krishna. Maybe the way you're going to counteract the difficulty is to chant more japa, to become more humble, to become more tolerant, to become more loving, to learn other ways of dealing with people, or to put yourself in a situation that's more conducive for your Krishna consciousness. I mean, I knew someone who was in a very difficult situation because that's how he was getting his money. And the situation was, it was causing him a lot of distress. And he realized, okay, if I leave this situation and do something that's more favorable for my Krishna consciousness, even though I'll get less money, then I'll be in a better position. So he did that. He became much happier, ended up getting more money in the long run. So if the solution is something that would please Krishna, if it's moral, if it's legal, if it's ethical, if it will increase my dependence on Krishna, certainly I should do it. But then even when I do that with dependence on Krishna. Not thinking, kartahami timanyate, not thinking I am the controller. By my intervention, I am going to counteract this difficulty because I am so powerful. No. It's like we were watching this following Srila Prabhupada the other day. One devotee was saying that he asked Prabhupada, what is humility? Prabhupada said, humility is when you think nothing will save you but Krishna. So if we're thinking, I'm going to get out of this situation by my vast intelligence, I'm going to be getting out of this situation because of the people I know, the connections I have, I'm going to get out of this situation because I have a lot of money. That's not the mentality. That's not the mentality. Then I'm taking shelter of those other things. Rather, I take shelter of Krishna. Krishna, if it is your desire to relieve me from this difficult situation, then let me act as your instrument according to your will, and let me try according to the means you have given me to counteract this situation if it's for your glory. We think about the devotees in Bombay with Mr. Nair, and how Prabhupada was using everything to try to counteract the situation with full dependence on Krishna. So that is the mood of the devotee. Of course, there's many more things we could talk about here in this purport and this verse. The story of Maharaj Parikshit is so wonderful. This Shanaka Rishi and the sages, they're so eager to hear about the Lord and his devotees. When we hear about the Lord and his devotees, first of all, we get a blueprint for our own action and our own lives. All of the questions we have about what to do, how to live, how to think, can be answered by studying the lives of devotees like Parikshit. And plus, because they are devotees, everything they do is full of nectar. And Krishna also becomes so happy when we hear about his devotees. Just like any parent becomes happy if you want to hear about their beloved child. So it's so wonderful. This Bhagavatam is operating on every level. It is operating on the level of a materially substantial, safe, prosperous kingdom. It is operating on the level of what do I do about dealing with this problem in my life? And it is operating on the level of let me ultimately run my life so that I am cooperating with the current of the Lord's Leela as it is exhibited in this world, particularly now with Mahaprabhu, so that even in this life, even in this body, I am part of the Lord's transcendental pastimes, at which point I no longer experience that I am in the material world, but I experience that I am part of the Lord's Leela. So unfortunately, for various reasons, I don't have a whole lot of time for question and discussion today. It takes just a little bit.
I have something. We don't discuss. Prabhupada was giving some was having some talks in New York years ago, 66, on CC, and he was telling this story about Mahaprabhu, told about the astrologer, telling the poor man he had a hidden inheritance. In the middle of that, he started talking about the bigu astrologers who can tell even past and future lives. And it was the bigu astrologer that said Prabhupada could build a house the whole world could live in. So anyway, he said that at the birth ceremony of Maharaj Parikit, an astrologer was reading his horoscope and said he was destined to die by snake bite. So when Sringi's father sent the messenger to inform the king about what his son had done to curse him to die of snake bite in 7 days, I think Maharaj Parikit also saw his destiny in that Krishna was telling him it was time to leave this world. But I have a question. Nityananda, who used to head up the New Orleans temple years ago, published a Mahabharata from Purna Prajna Prabhu's study of the Ganguly Mahabharata. I believe it was a Mahabharata. Anyway, Nityananda said him and his daughter edited the book, but I stopped reading it early on because I got to the story of Maharaj Parikit. And in this particular Mahabharata, it was saying that Maharaj Parikit took shelter of his palace. He locked himself up in his palace to avoid Sringi's curse. And he was having a festival on top of that. So in Vasuki, hidden some of the festival food, and he made it into the anyway, and Maharaj Parikit was bitten. And then Jamadagni killed all the snakes, his successor. So could you explain how that's possible, that we're dealing with a Bharata story that's different from the Bhagavat Purana, which is sometimes called, you know, the spotless Purana? So there's two different stories. Can you say something?
I'll do my best. We find this quite a bit. But we'll find that the stories of people with the same names and apparently the same stories are told differently in different Puranas or in different parts of the Shastra. And there's several answers for this. First of all, there are about, I think, 300 versions. Specifically, let's talk about the Mahabharata. There's about 300 versions of the Mahabharata. And according to Madhvacharya, certain parts of the Mahabharata have become corrupted. Therefore, we are not going to take the authority of the Mahabharata over the Bhagavatam when they conflict, especially if we're not sure about that particular version. So that's specifically in regard to the Mahabharata. We will certainly take the Mahabharata that's quoted in the Bhagavatam or that's quoted by the Acharyas. I mean, Srila Prabhupada quotes specific sections of the Mahabharata, as do other Acharyas, as did Madhvacharya himself. As far as different versions of different stories, I have several answers for that. One is that Srila Prabhupada explains that the Shastras were not designed as history in the modern Western sense. They are not told in the order of time. They're not told in chronological order. And often the same story, apparently the same story, is often a compilation of many similar stories that happened, as Prabhupada says, on different planets, at different times, or in different universes. So it's a quite a different way of telling a story than we're accustomed to in our particular culture. And we're looking at, okay, how could both versions be right? You know, one must be wrong and the other one must be right. But one story may not be, the story we're reading may not be a story that happened all on one planet to the same person at the same time or even in the same universe. It's a compilation. Another thing is that the stories are told by different people who have different angles of vision. And you might say, well, okay, but they're all liberated souls, so it should all tell the story the same way. You know, we're accustomed to the fact that if you have five conditioned souls experiencing the same thing, that they're going to talk about it in very different ways. In fact, I was just reading that one-third of convictions, criminal convictions, based on eyewitness accounts, are later found false from DNA testing. One-third. So the eyewitness says, that's the guy, I know it, I'll swear it, I've seen him anywhere. If it wasn't him, it was his twin brother. Absolutely, positively, without a doubt, and one-third of them are just wrong. Just plain old wrong. So we're used to that in conditioned life, and we expect that, you know, we find this in our own family situation, that one person says, this is what happened, and the other one says, no, that's not what happened, this is what happened. No, I remember exactly, you said this, I did not say that, I never said that. Well, yes, you did, I heard you, no, I didn't say that. And then you went there. No, I didn't go there. Why do you think I, right? And we both live through the same thing and we experience the same thing and we tell a whole different story about it. I know there's a situation with Srila Prabhupada where I heard one other devotee who was there when I was there tell the story, and I said, no, it didn't happen like that. It happened like this. She said, well, I remember it like this. Well, I remember it like this. And we asked someone else who was there and they had a third opinion. So we may think that if we're dealing with all liberated souls, that that kind of subjectivity due to imperfect senses, imperfect memory, and I have to say cheating propensity, is not going to be there. However, there is a transcendental version of this material bias. Because even in the transcendental world, everyone is an individual, and individuals do have their own perspective. The way you can see that people can have their own perspective without it being due to cheating is think about a physical location. If you can think about, say, a series of rooms in a house, and you put people at different places in the house and ask them to describe what they see, or even people in different corners of a room, especially if it's a room that leads into other rooms, and ask them to describe the room. So one person is only going to see certain things. It's not that each of the person will be able to see everything, and they're going to have, as Prabhupada uses the term, different angles of vision. So this operates in the highest transcendental realm. The example that I always give is when Krishna wakes up in the morning, Mother Yasoda's view of what Krishna looks like and the view of the young gopis in the room is quite different. So they're both seeing Krishna, but Mother Yasoda says, oh, Krishna didn't get a proper bath last night. Look at this. He's got dirt all over his body. And the young gopis in the room who know that Krishna actually got up and was out rasa dancing in the middle of the night, they know that what's on his body is not due to an improper bath, but due to his nocturnal activities. In the same way, Krishna's grabbed Radharani's chatter by mistake, and Mother Yasoda thinks it's Balaram's chatter, whereas the young gopis understand it's Radharani's chatter. So if Mother Yasoda's telling the story, she's going to say, so Krishna wakes up in the morning, he's got Balaram's chatter on, and he has some dirt on his body because he wasn't given a proper bath. Now, from her perspective, that's how she sees things, and she's certainly a liberated soul, free from any of the four defects. So I see that we have all these different reasons why there may be different accounts. First reason is that some shastras may have remained more pure than others. Some of the Shastras have become corrupted. Next reason is that the stories we hear are compilations. And therefore, different stories may be different kinds of compilations. It may be a compilation of 20 different stories that took place on different planets and different ages with different people that had similar names and similar circumstances. So one compilation may have one set of facts and one may have another. And the last reason is that different people telling the story do have their individual transcendental perspective. And therefore, they are going to tell their perspective. And that's, I think, the best that I can do. And I'm not saying that those three are the only answers. I'm sure there are more answers. I could take one more question.
I'll ask a question, probably not a great question. Let me make one small comment on Vidugda's, what he was talking about. I actually think we were discussing yesterday that sometimes these leelas, or often when these leelas are performed, they're not always performed the same. They vary, just like if someone's company's performing a play, the play isn't always done exactly the same. And the example I was giving, I think, yesterday, the day before, that when Balaram, at Krishna's birth, Balaram sometimes appears as the elder brother, and sometimes he appears as the younger brother. So, you know, the leelas vary, and therefore we can hear different accounts. A question I was going to ask was, it seems unusual that Lord Chaitanya, who's Patita Pavana, coming to save the most fallen, would come so early in the age of Kali. I mean, Kali Yuga, 427,000 years, so we're 5,000 years into it. That's barely like a tenth of a percent. You'd think that maybe, you know, saving the most fallen, Lord Chaitanya would have waited and come later in the Kali Yuga. And I don't know if there's any other answer other than, you know, the inconceivable will of the Lord, but what are your thoughts on that?
Since I cannot cite anything from Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra to answer that question, I can't say anything. I have not seen any place at any time any answer to that question. It would have to be completely speculative, and I'm not willing to do that.
Okay. I kind of thought that might be the answer. A couple of good questions for you written down, but you answered them all.
All right, Krishna. Okay, thank you very much. I'm sorry that I have to go at this point. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.
Hari Bol.
Hari Bol.
Thank you for
Hare
Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.